Hi, and welcome to episode 24 of Cavalier Cast, The Civil War in Words, a podcast that looks at anything and everything to do with the Wars of the Three Kingdoms. Last episode, I spoke to Dominic Pearce, the latest biographer of James Graham, Marquess of Montrose. Now, many of you have said how much you enjoyed finding out more about Montrose, the man, and it quickly became apparent that there was just so much to talk about with Montrose that a second episode quickly came about. Today, Warwick and I, like true headmasters, are going to assess Montrose's military record. Will we agree on his greatest victory, for example? And what caused his defeat at Philippore? Then we'll dive into some historic what-ifs. So what if the King's cavalry had linked up with Montrose in the aftermath of the Naseby disaster in June 1645? How would Montrose have fared in a pitched battle against Fairfax or Cromwell? Now that's one for the war gamers who are listening. Let us know if you've fought that scenario, please. If you have any comments about any of the podcast topics, please get in touch. I'd love to hear from you. That's at 1642author if you're on Twitter, or 1642author.com. But now, on to the episode. Okay, Warwick, so welcome back. Time to talk about Montrose this episode.
It is indeed. Controversial figure. Some love him, some hate him, you know, but he looms large on the 17th century and the Civil Wars, definitely.
Yeah, there's definitely some things you can't take away from Montrose, isn't there? But others that are more debatable. So what do you think was his greatest victory?
So he obviously has, you know, this series of victories, you know, firstly fighting for the Covenantal Army, so places like Brigadier, and then obviously his year of miracles, so he's got Tippermuir and Aberdeen, Fife and Blocky, Aldern, Kilsyth, you know. The issue is a lot of those battles follows, you know, the typical Highland Army tactical doctrine. So you advance to contact with a firefight, you skirmish against the other side, you let off musket volleys to break up the cohesion, and then once that happens, okay, you have a formation about six ranks deep. You drop down your muskets. You pick up your swords and your targes and your lock arbor axes, and you charge in there, smash and break apart the enemy cohesion. And that's the end of the battle. And most of these battles, you know, go on. They're over in a relatively short time. The problem is that with, you know, a lot of these battles, you know, that Montrose gets involved in, you know, it is the same tactics being used again and again and again. You know, there's no innovation there whatsoever. Okay, he's found a method that works, okay, and he's sticking to it, basically. And that's all right, because obviously his opponents, the Covenanters that he's fighting against in Scotland, they are not the first team. They are not the top tier. They are, you know, very much second-rate troops, local levies. You know, they're being ruled by committees of war with you know, personal grievances, you know, being used as their main aim rather than pursuing the, you know, the war in Scotland against Montrose. So, you know, he's fighting a second tier and he's very lucky in doing that. In terms of, though, you know, something where he does something different, his best victory, I think, is probably Alford's. Alford is different in that he's very much innovative there. You know, rather than just putting himself up on a slope at the beginning of battle and charging down into the Covenant ranks, he uses a reverse slope position to hide his numbers. He may well have also fooled Bailey into thinking that he'd retreated, and he leaves a party on the ridge to look like a rear guard. So he's trying to draw the Covenanters, you know, into a trap. Obviously, Bailey has to come across the Ford of Don. And that immediately leads into marshy ground. And if you're getting into marshy ground, obviously your formations are going to get disordered and broken up. You can't keep cohesion in that. And rather than, you know, doing what he's done previously with his forces, arraying them, you know, as an army with Highlanders at the front and cavalry very much in the rear, so that when the Highlanders can smash in, cavalry can be used to pursue the broken enemy. Rather than doing that at Alford's, Montrose arrays them like a typical pike and shot typical 17th century army of the time. He has his infantry in the center and his cavalry on the flanks. And this shows Montrose confidence in converting from typical clan methods of warfare into using conventional warfare, because he knows he needs to convert to the tactics of the time in order to properly smash the Covenanters in front of him as well. What he also does, though, at Alford, he plays off of clan allegiances and rivalries, and he uses this, to motivate his troops. Obviously, his cavalry at Alford is led by Nathaniel Gordon, and for the battle, Bailey has raided Lord Huntley's, who is one of Gordon's clansmen, one of his kinsmen. So they've raided his lands, and at the rear of the Covenanter army, there's supposed to be cattle held in pens. And Montrose goes over to Gordon and says, look, they've got all your cavalry, go and retrieve them. And Gordon, thinking, this is all for my family, I've got my honor to retrieve. He goes in there and smashes everything in front of him as well. As well as that, although McCullough is not present at Alford, he does have a couple of Irish regiments with him. They deviate their tactics. They're being charged by cavalry. The regiment will open its ranks and allows the cavalry to pass through, closes up its ranks again. The Irish draw knives. They're hamstringing the horses. They're being taken down. And then they're firing into the rear of those units as well. And certainly in the aftermath to the battle at Alford, it is effective in that by destroying Bailey's forces, it then puts the Covenanters on a back foot and say, look, we've actually got a big problem here. We've got to come out into the field. We've got to defeat Montrose once and for all. And by pushing them out of the way as well at Alford, Montrose can then look at the wider picture. At Alford, he will have just heard, if he has heard at all, about the defeat of King's army at Naseby, and will obviously be aware, that he needs some relief of some sort.
I see what you're saying. I love the second division, the Lord and Covenant Force, the second division. Similarities there then when you were describing it with Naseby, isn't it? That's a bit what Fairfax did at Naseby, wasn't it? He deployed part of his force without sight to entice the royalists, which obviously worked. Strange that they're both happening at similar times.
Very much so, very much so. Obviously, he's had the previous year, fighting, that place like Tippermuir and Aberdeen and so on and so forth. And I do wonder whether it is a case that he's used those as practice battles, to see what the clans can do. He's had the winter of 1644, 1645, to sit down and think, how do we go on the offensive? And by June, July of 1645, he's got the measure of the force that's under him, and he can start doing things that are different from it as well. Now, Alford, if anything, is Montrose's nadir. It's the peak where he can do something, that is slightly different with his army as well.
Do you think I chose the same one?
I've got a dread thinking. I think I might know which one you're going to go for, but go on.
See if you can guess. Come on, tell us which one. Then. No, but I was thinking that. And I'll tell you why I was thinking that.
I would have criticized you if you'd gone for Alden. I would have had birds.
Well, I haven't. I picked Inverlochy.
That's interesting. I said I was thinking about that.
Yeah, and the reason I picked it was just how miraculous it was that he was practically annihilated in the Great Glen. Covenanter armies at either side of that. There's no way out. And he covers this amazing sort of 30 miles or something in 36 hours. Yeah. He gets out of that trap miraculously, stunning the Covenanter forces. Totally turns the tables, rushes down the hills of Ben Nevis, defeats Argyle on his very doorstep at Inverlochy Castle. And I just think that in terms of the magnitude of that victory, it just blasts a hole in not just Argyle's personal morale, it blasts a hole in the Covenant of government, the Campbell lands themselves, right in the heartlands.
And then, you know, the reverberations there, you've got Huntley, who's who sends his cavalry to Montrose, and Montrose has always been desperate for cavalry, you know, and the writing to the king at the end of that battle saying, you know, we're going to come, Your Majesty, and this by summer we'll be leading an army across. And
I totally agree with you. I think if you're going to put Montrose on a pedestal, forget about Auldearn. Okay, it is Inverlochy, because it's showing you that the potential of this army is a forced march. Okay, that, you know, it shouldn't come out at the end of it. Okay, and be able to win this big, you know, big battle. Well, it's not big, but it you know, by Highland standard, it's relatively good size. And of course, the Covenanters are going to see this. Okay, and you know, trying to campaign against Montrose is going to put them on the back foot. Because they can defend all these garrisons all they want, but if he's able to force march, you know, over, you know, some pretty hard terrain, it's going to make them think. Well, where is he going to pop up next? Basically, I think
exactly. Yeah, you know, you've even got sort of he escapes that, and then Argyle heads towards Inverlochy Castle. The royalists are spotted on the top of Ben Nevis, spotted by Argyle, and Argyle thinks that there's no way that can be the royalist force. They're just stragglers, you know, and there's 1,500 of them sitting there ready to pounce.
Yeah.
and it's that disbelief, isn't it? And then he's sailing off into the sunset, leaving his army straight to Edinburgh. He's going there with his arm in a sling. He's totally defeated. He's chiseling out Montrose's coat of arms from Parliament. Yeah. You know, that's the best he can do. Okay, so we've got Inverlochy and Auldearn. And I didn't know Inverlochy and
definitely not Auldearn. Yeah. Trying to turn the tables, ladies and gents. It's rigged.
Yeah, Inverlochy and Alfred, right?
And Alfred.
Yeah. So the next two questions we've got are hypothetical. So this is where I can get quite interesting. So let's see where we both end up in our thoughts on this one. Then, so let's say King's Cavalry managed to link up after Naseby with Montrose. Let's ignore the fact that Lord Digby is incompetent. What do you think happens next?
Well, I think you've got to remember by 1645, okay, the Solemn League and Covenant that's been signed, you know, late 1643, early 44, is looking very, very shaky. The Earl of Leven by this point is at Worcester. And he's not very happy about the lack of support and commitment to the Solemn Covenant. So on that front, okay, you've got the new model in the field, you've got the Solemn League and Covenant. Are they likely to be mutually supportive of each other? Probably not. And as such, you know, to fill the vacuum, you know, Prince Rupert, okay, let's say he has, you know, been victorious at Naseby, he either has to attack the Scots, get them out of the way, or Charles, on the other hand, okay, can try and sow discord amongst the Covenanters. Okay, he can sign an engagement with them. And that way, he's got the Covenant on side, he's got Montrose on side, and quite possibly as well, you know, he's having inroads with the Irish Confederates over in Ireland as well. Could probably sign something with them as well. And although there's still campaigning still happening in the southwest under Goring, you know, the royalist track record of not supporting Montrose, you know, coupled with the numerical superiority against him, I do feel that it's probably unlikely Rupert would have been sent immediately to relieve Montrose. I think, you know, their priority first is to stabilize what's happening in England. So riding into the West, you know, going to support the likes of Goring, securing, you know, the port of Bristol. And that way, you've then got a clean supply route through to the Welsh marches as well. And with that kind of strategic advantage on their side, you know, the Covenanters are going to be more amenable to engaging with the king, you know, even if it puts the principles of the Covenant, you know, on hot water as well. And I think it's by doing this strategy in stages, you know, rather than, you know, taking on everything the Parliament has to throw against them, okay, you know, that Montrose has a chance. So making engagement with the king, Montrose partially siding with the Covenanters, then got enough weight, okay, to push down into England, take on the likes of the Northern and Midland associations, and then hopefully, okay, through this attrition, join up, okay, with the king's army as well. I think just sending out a flying column of cavalry, I think there's still too many things between the king's army and Montrose, and vice versa for Montrose trying to ride down south.
Yeah.
You know, that's going to stop it. You know, I think it would still be a long shot, you know, whatever happens.
Yeah, I agree with you there. So, I mean, in reality, you've got, after Naseby, the king is in South Wales. He's aiming to recruit replacement infantry. But I guess, you know, nothing can really replace the infantry he's lost. You know, he's lost veteran infantry that were really, really the backbone of his army. But, you know, it's still a threat that if he recruits several thousand new recruits in Wales, and you see him, you know, Rupert's going to Bristol. So you sort of see him securing that southwest. You know, Goran's there, Rupert's positioned in Bristol. He's going to hold that. And that's when the king makes that decision that he's going to head north and link up with Montrose and finally take him, the horseman, you know, that's escaped Naseby, and give him them. And Digby goes. And I think if Digby got through, I really can't see any scope for Montrose coming south into England.
No.
It just wouldn't work, because the biggest asset is Montrose being in Scotland, because that itself, just having him up there, even, you know, that at that point when he's wiped out all of the local second division Covenant of forces, the fact that he's in Scotland is drawn back David Leslie with the cavalry. It's starting to draw back the entire Covenanter army. And for Charles and for Rupert, you know, that's what they want. They want a reconquest of the north of England. And with the Scots going up into Scotland, Montrose has drawn them away and given the king that other chance. So I think even if Digby got through with several thousand of the king's cavalry, that would give Montrose enough of what he needed to start to deal with David Leslie, first of all, stay in Scotland, because the worst thing that happened for Montrose is that he won, you know, cleared Scotland. And at that point, like, you know, in the New Model Army, we see when Charles is defeated, the divisions and the factions come out.
Yeah.
And that's the same for Montrose. McCullough thinks, well, job done. I'm going at the West Coast. I'm now, my prime loyalty is MacDonald cause.
Yeah.
Montrose is then, his army's whittled away, and that's when he's left really in a point where it's a knife edge, where Parliament is waiting to be summoned. Montrose is there. He hasn't got the forces he needs anymore. The Covenants are heading back north to deal with him. And if Digby had got through, perhaps you could have bought enough time for that Parliament to sort of be assembled, perhaps vote men, munitions, money to Montrose. And that could have ultimately turned the table. So probably the best thing is if Montrose just stays in Scotland, don't go.
Exactly. You know, he needs to act like a fifth column, basically, you know, and then just pick away at it.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, by doing that as well, you know, going on, you know, post-August 1645, you know, the Covenant is going to, you know, rain hell and high water down on him, you know, just to get rid of him, get him out of the way. So, yeah, no, definitely. It doesn't help either coming down into the Lowlands, because you know that's going to put them on the back foot either. Stay up in the Highlands, okay, where you know what you're doing, where you've got ready supply of troops and soldiers and people loyal to you. Just pick away.
And as you say, you know, tactics-wise, if it worked, it worked. You know, and he's got the terrain, he's got the tactics that worked. You can't go on and on forever just charging wildly into enemy ranks, because eventually, like Culloden, they get wise, don't they? And think, oh, here we go. You know,
which leads very well into the next question, to be really honest.
Yes. Okay. So, another hypothetical. How would Montrose have fared in a pitched battle on English soil with perhaps Cromwell and Fairfax?
People are going to hate me for this. Okay, not well. Although Montrose, okay, you know, his training, you know, over in Angers and then fighting with the Covenant army in the Bishop's Wars is in conventional pike and shot warfare. He needs the following with his Highland army to have any potential for success. So he needs terrain. Yeah. He needs numbers. He needs artillery, which he doesn't have any of at all. And if he can't ensure, you know, the numbers, you know, that he has, you know, at say Alford or Kilsyth, if he can't ensure there's not going to be that, you know, animosity between the clans not only on either side, but on his own side as well, you know, that his troops actually follow orders, you know, and just, you know, charge in at the first opportunity. They don't get carried away. You know, if he can't ensure any of those things, he's not really got a chance at all. You know, when he fights at you know, Brigadier, you know, against the Royalist Army in 1639, you know, he's relying on using conventional tactics. So he's using the attritional action of artillery fire rather than doing anything, you know, innovative with it. And, you know, put that into position with a numerically and an experiential superior army in the form of the Parliamentarian Army against Fairfax and Cromwell. You know, weight of numbers is going to absorb that attrition of artillery. So his only real chance I can see against someone like Cromwell or Fairfax is picking away at them, you know, skirmishing, you know, not getting into a sustained firefight, you know, but drawing them on.
But what do you think? Say the miraculous happened and he manages to get some of his Highland army south. You know, they don't desert. They don't think, well, that's not our place. And the English accept, you know, and support this army moving south. Even if he does sort of get McCullough and his troops south, which, again, Catholics, Irish, you know, that there'd be an outcry, wouldn't there, from the Parliamentarian side and from, you know, general English men and women.
Yeah.
But say he does get them there, I wonder how the new model army would have fared against these crazy troops charging at them, shouting, screaming. You know, would that have potentially unnerved them a little bit enough to sort of clinch maybe one victory?
I think so. I mean, that is quite possible. I think on the one hand, you know, you're not used to these kind of tactics. You're used to fighting a conventional army, so. And let's be honest, you know, if you're armed with pike and shots, you know, forget about the shot. Once you get past that pike point, okay, and you've got a sword and a targe, you know, and a musket, but you don't stand much chance. You can go forward, you can go backwards, okay, can't do anything with that pike. So, you know, if they can get in amongst those regiments, it's going to be a different story. The problem is, okay, is the musketry, okay, the artillery that can be brought to bear on them. As well. So yes. On the other hand, you know, that there's the Catholic element as well. You know, and I do feel if they're coming down, okay, it's also going to have a galvanizing effect, not just on the Parliamentarian armies, but on the local communities they're going to be marching through as well. And, you know, whether they're going to form the likes of clubmen, okay, you know, skirmish against him on the march, you know.
Yeah,
it's a hypothetical, but I think it is something that needs to be considered. But, you know, if he's going to come up against Cromwell and Fairfax in an open field, he can't skirmish with them, can't use conventional tactics, you know, against them. You know, we're talking about another Culloden. The alternative, okay, and there is an alternative. If he can get himself into a fortress and he can, you know, get himself into, you know, some earthworks and trenches as he, you know, attempts to do it at Fivey, he's not going to have a complete victory against the Parliamentarian army, but he is going to be able to hold out a lot longer, okay, than if he's trying to fight them in the open fields. Getting into a fortress, getting into a castle, getting into a stately home and holding them at arm's length, I think is probably, you know, his best bet, if not getting in, you know, a total victory, you know, at least getting a partial victory.
Interesting. Certainly. The what ifs. But I think it's clear, it's, you know, this is, even with Montrose at that point, at the end of 1645, it's still quite a big shot for the king to pull something off. But it's not impossible. I think that's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's often given that Naseby was that was it. The king was... there was no chance after Naseby, but actually there was a number of different chances where he could have either prolonged the war or potentially clinched something through some sort of alliance.
Oh, absolutely. Or military. And I think, you know, going on into 1646, you know, you look at how desperate and how nasty the fighting really, really does. It shows, you know, these are last ditch efforts, you know, to get something out of it. And Montrose, okay, there's very little chance of him succeeding. You know, he's sent north, you know, with 20 horsemen. You know, it was never a case, you know, of it succeeding. It's a desperate action, okay, for a desperate time, you know. whether you win big field victories or at least, you know, a trick, you know, the enemy force, you know, that's still contributing to your war effort. So, you know, Montrose, although it is very desperate, although it is a very, very tall order, it's still contributing to, you know, staying in the field, basically.
Now, what about these massacres? So, I mean, he gets a lot of stick, doesn't he, for Dumfries and Aberdeen.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
It is fair, but I think this all goes back to the fact, you know, how much control does he actually have over this one derby? Obviously, you know, the rules of war in the 17th century, if a town, you know, resists, okay, and you're forced to storm it, you know, the town is supposed to be yours. So you can do with it as you will, sack it and, you know, take the populace on. The problem is, okay, is as well as that, you know, a lot of blame gets put on McCollum as well, who seems to be egging on not only the Highlanders, but also his own troops as well. Yeah. Whether that's a case of, you know, passing blame for what happens from Montrose to McCollum and using him as a bit of a scapegoat, which does seem to happen in quite a lot of the accounts of you know, Montrose's rebellion. I don't really know, but it is a massacre. It is unexcusable. It does have a big effect on his war effort because people see what he's done. You know, they're far less likely, you know, to side with him in the Highlands, certainly. You know, if they're willing to do this to Aberdeen, what they're going to do to your local village as well. So certainly, I don't think it does Montrose any good. Is he responsible for it? I think it's for the individual to decide. I don't think he can't be, you know, he's not all squeaky clean.
Yeah, well, that's right. I don't think any commander can be squeaky clean, can they? You know, we can isolate Montrose and say, yeah, that's not acceptable. But when you look at other commanders, it happens to a lot of other commanders in England as well. I mean, certainly Ireland. And as you say, the rules of war would support that. But Montrose doesn't strike me as a commander that is accepting of this behavior. You know, if he had the choice, he would stop it. But unfortunately, he's trying to balance the books a lot as well in those early days of that year of miracles, isn't he? You know, he's got McCullough is a fire eater. He wants to go and burn and plunder. You know, he wants to sort of reestablish MacDonald territory.
I think as well, going forward from Aberdeen, you know, by you know, them putting the town to the sword, afterwards, you know, Montrose comes up against other people and you know, reveals to them, you know, that McCollum is there. It's almost like using him as a strong man, you know, saying, you know, look, if you don't do what I do, I'm going to set this guy on you, you know. So that's, I think there's a bit of that as well. So
And I mean, and the other thing as well is at Kilsyth, he's quartering his army away from Glasgow because he knows that the temptation to loot it may be too strong. So he is taking action to avoid, you know, these temptations.
It's very interesting you say that, because that is exactly what he does. And it's what it's very much what the Jacobite army does in 1746 as well, in that they winter in and around Stirling and Falkirk. Bonnie Prince Charlie, of course, is splitting his time between Bannockburn House and Glasgow as well, very much for exactly the same reasons as well. So, you know, people in command of these armies, they know they are capable of some things, but they also know, you know, there is a clan loyalty there as well. You know, that supersedes, you know, them being under their command as well. So keeping away from these, you know, the big places of habitation, otherwise there's going to be a bit of a Highland-Lowland dichotomy, you know, going on here. So, yeah.
They're exactly what you see there. You've got religion, you've got clans, and you've got just the fact that it's Highland and Lowland, you know. So there's three different elements at play, isn't there?
And you know, what happens with Montrose as well, you know, people in Scotland have a very, very long memory and going forward into the 1680s and 1690s, when the Covenanters are still around. You know, Highlanders coming from, you know, the Highlands down to the Lowlands, you know, get a very, very bad press because people can still remember what they did in the 1640s as well. So it creates, you know, a huge division within Scotland as well. You know, that doesn't get solved, you know, quite a few centuries. So, yeah.
But the partnership then, Montrose McCullough. So you said there that there was clearly cracks in it, wasn't there? And they weren't working too well. And let's face it, they had totally different objectives, didn't they, really? You know, McCullough wasn't fighting for the king. He wasn't fighting to get into England. It's almost like sort of by happen chance that he's fighting for a cause that works for the MacDonald clan, and that happens to be the king.
Absolutely. You know, he's there by happen chance, you know, really. He's using it, you know, as a means of getting this aim, you know, which is, you know, raising a MacDonald hegemony and persecuting Campbells. You know, he is very single-minded in that. And if, you know, it means, you know, making a deal with the devil and going over the king, then by all means do it. You know, that it's a means to an end, basically. And I think that's both Montrose and McCullough that, you know, see that. Montrose, you know, is using McCullough, you know, as a means to an end to have some professional soldiery in his army. You know, that aren't clan soldiers, that aren't clan levies, you know, that have fought in battle before. Whereas, you know, McCullough wants to be fighting, you know, in the West and, you know, securing his garrisons, persecuting Campbells. But he can't achieve that, okay, without, you know, some of Montrose's support as well. So it's a marriage of convenience, very much so.
When you look at the detail, it's quite clear, isn't it, that Montrose could have fought without McCullough, but McCullough probably couldn't have fought without Montrose, could he?
No, I mean, Robert Bailey says, you know, quite clearly, you know, McCullough to Montrose was the smallest string in his bow and a design he least trusted in as well. So, you know, even Robert Bailey, you know, who's on the Covenant side, is aware, you know, that neither side is totally trusting of each other.
Yeah.
You know, doesn't necessarily need each other either. But, you know, McCullough, you know, going off the West and raiding, it's not ideal for Montrose in that, you know, he can't pursue his campaigns the way he would like it to because he doesn't have the numbers. But it has a morale effect in that raiding and burning and pillaging, you know, on the Western coast. And that's going to be stretching Covenanter forces as well. So on the one hand, you know, it's very, very unhelpful, you know, because Montrose can't do what he wants to do. On the other hand, you know, it's stretched Covenanter forces thin as well, basically.
Yeah. And then just last thing on Montrose and McCullough. So, you know, putting McCullough on a field of battle without Montrose, he's not really general material, is he, McCullough? No. Whereas Montrose is.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a couple of times that Montrose leads in the main attack, but he does tend to stay at the back, which is a good place for a general to be, because the general gets killed, you know, that is, you know, no one knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
But McCullough is one who, you know, puts himself in the front rank and charges in there as well. So, you know, he's very much, you know, he's leading from the front.
He's an extreme Rupert, isn't he? He's an absolutely extreme Rupert.
But at the same time, I think as well, okay, you know, that there are glimpses, you know, of a professional soldier there. For example, okay, I mean, if you look at one of the things I do not understand about Montrose's campaigns, apart from maybe Kilsyth, he doesn't use scouts. He doesn't put pickets out in front of his armies, you know, and, you know,
yeah.
When Montrose does get in trouble, you know, that's half the battle, you know, that he should have thought about beforehand.
Yeah.
What does happen at Aldern is that McCullough supposedly hears that the Montrose hasn't bothered to put pickets out, and he goes, right, you six men, okay, go out there, okay, and see what the Covenanters are doing. And they go out and Uri, who's coming up the road, what he does before he gets into Aldern, he has all of his musketeers, you know, clean out their damp powder from the night before. So he fires a volley, you know, to announce that he's there.
Yeah.
And it's the scouts that hear it, you know. So, okay, you know, McCullough is very much, you know, he's very much a Rupert character as well. But he also does know the use of intelligence, and he has got a bit of a handle of military theory as well.
Okay, what about Philippore then? So I think this is prime territory for that scout issue, yes. Isn't it? So he's not himself. He's sleeping away from his men. He's not with them. He's off guard. He's not as alert. He's dismissed rumors of David Lesley approaching. You know, this is a complete defeat. It ends the year of miracles. McCullough's not there.
No, he's not there at all. I mean, he's left on the 2nd of September, and Aboyne and the Gordons have also left the following day as well. So, you know, he is pretty much on his own. He's got about a force of 200 Irish soldiers from O'Kane's. He's got some horse. He's got about 1,000 Moss troopers that he's picked up, and Gala Shields on the border as well. So, it's not, you know, the force that he's fought, you know, the previous year with. Okay, it's a threadbare force at the very most. And obviously, you know, he's beaten Bailey at Kilsyth. The Covenanters are now, you know, sitting up and going, well, we've got to deal with this. We've got to deal with this right now. And so they send Lesley north with 3,000 cavalry, 700 foot, and 400 dragoons. Not a big force, okay? Not something that's going to completely and utterly destroy Montrose's forces, but certainly enough, you know, that it's going to bolster the local Covenant command as well. And you're absolutely right. He's not on top form. You know, he keeps on getting reports from this, from locals, you know, Lesley is in the area. And he says, no, he's not. And I said, I'll completely ignore this. On the 12th, the Covenanters, they ambush, you know, Montrose's outpost at Sunderland, which is just north of Selkirk. It's Charteris of Amersfield and 2 to 3 others that escape. And then again, they come up to Montrose and say, look, Lesley is in the area and he's looking for a fight. And Montrose goes, you're absolutely wrong. Okay. You've got in a drunken brawl with someone. Okay. I'm not going to pass judgment on this. Okay. It's not a problem. Mm. And, you know, he's really not thinking. I do wonder, it's a big claim to make. I do wonder, okay, whether what he's achieved, you know, at Aldern, Orford, and Kilsyth, okay, whether, you know, these big ones that he's been flaunted for, if it's gone a bit to his head, to be brutally honest, because he's dividing his officers, okay, their abilities are over at Selkirk, all of his rank and file are over in Philippore. There's no connection between them at all. So if Lesley does come in and attack them, you know, he's going to take time for them to get into position, get them formed up. And that's what happens on the 13th of September. And it's farcical, you know, what happens because, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning, Montrose is at breakfast, gets alerted, so has to get all of his officers out of the town over to Philippore, where he sees that the entire, you know, Border's force is in uproar and confusion. They haven't even formed a proper line of battle. The Irish are running away with the baggage train. There's only about 100 left on the field. You know, what Irish they are, they have set themselves up around farms. There's cavalry charging into them. They're seeing them off. Cavalry charging into them again, getting in amongst them, breaking them up. What cavalry he has, they're not doing the Swedish tactics of charging into the sword beforehand. They're firing at the Covenanters with pistols. Covenanters very quickly are getting in amongst them, okay, and absolutely tearing them apart as well. So, you know, by 12 o'clock, you know, by in the afternoon, and battle's starting at 10, you know, it is pretty much all over. It's completely and utterly routed, yeah. So, you know, I don't know what he's doing, okay. It is farcical as a battle, okay. He has very much lost his edge, unfortunately.
Mm. I mean, Dominic Pearce, so Montrose's latest biographer, is saying that he thinks Montrose is suffering from exhaustion by that point. But, you know, the other thing here as well is, so, you know, that entire defeat, and McCullough's not there, you know, he's took his men off. As you say, the Gordons have gone. It's that point of ultimate victory. But also, he's been lured into a trap, isn't he? So he's got those lowland peers, Traquair, the Earl of Traquair, claiming that they're going to support him. And in the meantime, they're just trying to sort of delay him for Lesley to arrive. Some of, I think, Traquair's son abandons Montrose during the night. So, you know, he's been betrayed. He's got large chunks of his men that are not there. He's had to give some of them furlough. And part of that furlough was to avoid them either deserting or looting and pillaging if he's kept them there against his will. So we can't really win. But I don't think that Philippa was a defeat just because McCullough wasn't there.
No.
Definitely more than that. I mean, that is an element, but there's a lot more at play, isn't there?
There's a lot going on. And I think as well, you know, he can see what is happening to the king, you know, post Naseby as well. There is that always hanging over his head as well. And remember, okay, he sent north, okay, to raise forces, okay, and set an army down, okay, to get the king out of this tricky situation that he's got himself into. And, you know, it's you know, September, you know, 1645. He's been sent up here in 44, and he's still not done it, you know. So there must be an element of guilt that's hanging over him as well, I think.
You're right. I mean, if he's heard about Naseby, which I guess he would have done by that point. But yeah, so interesting stuff, isn't it? Interesting talking a bit about those what ifs.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that Montrose, okay, however much we can criticize his battlefield performance, I think, you know, despite, you know, as much mud as we can throw at him, okay, he's got genuine, you know, he genuinely wants, you know, to have a role and to support the king. And if nothing else, okay, he is to be commended for that, and should be remembered better than he is, certainly, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Last word on Montrose. I think honourable.
Honourable, I think, is the word for it. You know, yeah. I tend to pin my colours to the parliamentarian mast, but I could be tempted to waver with Montrose. You know, if nothing else, okay, he's an honourable gentleman.
Honourable, but should use scouts more. That's his headmaster's report. Well, that's not a bad report, is it? You know,
not at all. As I said, you know, that could do better. Okay, but you know, I'd take that on my school report. I think so.
Yeah, 17th century battle report. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah,
that's pretty good.
This is not Digby, so
yeah, exactly. Smashing. Oh, thanks again, Warwick. I mean, again, another fascinating discussion to end.
Absolute pleasure. Always a pleasure, Mark.
Montrose's memory is kept alive today by the First Marquess of Montrose Society, founded by the late Alan McPherson in 1996. Membership is £20 per year, and they have a great site with many resources. Next time, I'll be covering the 1650 Battle of Dunbar, between Cromwell and the Covenanters. Until then, I hope you've enjoyed listening. Please show your support by rating Cavaliercast on your podcast platform.